Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, we've got a very slow-moving programme ahead of us tonight. Why am I saying that? It's because Ain has always given out to me if I say we've got another very busy and fast-moving programme.
Yes, we're going to speak. I'm going to speak slowly and distinctly.
Oh, no, you're not.
Oh, yes, I am indeed. I'm reformed.
Anyway, I believe you were at the Oris recently.
That's right. The President of Ireland has garden parties every year, the last week in June. And the great and the good and even the not so good are invited along to these. So I was invited because I'm in the Tree Council, and different days have different themes, and the day I was there was for a community group. So as the Tree Council is certainly a community group, myself and Siobhan were invited along.
Who's Siobhan?
Siobhan Quinn. Oh, Siobhan Quinn is my best friend in the Tree Council. She saves our bacon time and time again, and she was invited to come along and bring a significant other. I was the significant other.
Oh, lovely, Ian. I never knew. Isn't that wonderful? Congratulations.
Yeah, so I dressed up in my finery, my lovely red
gruner. Did they have a red carpet?
Well, I wasn't walking on that, but
because you know when people
sure
are on the red carpet,
yes.
The journalists always shout, "Who are you wearing?" So what did you wear?
I wore a lovely red gula with white spots on it and a white linen jacket.
You didn't wear a fascinator, no?
No, I do hats wear it. No, hats wear it and required. I mean, it wasn't.
Fascinator isn't a hat.
Well, it's a mini hat. For people who haven't the neck to wear a hat, you only want to wear a mini hat. Indeed. But anyway, look, we're not going to talk about hats. It was a great day. There was a marquee. We had lovely food. The sun shone. It was great. It sounds gorgeous.
Anyway, listen, later on we're going to be talking about a book called The Language of Trees by Katie Holton.
Yes, indeed. Katie Holton was in touch with me over the last 2 years when she was working on this tree alphabet, because I've been in the Tree Council, I was telling
tree
her.
Tree alphabet?
Well, that's part of the book, you see, because we have a tree alphabet in Ireland from medieval times. It was the forerunner of Ulm. And I was explaining to her about this, and she was devising one of her own. But actually, it turned out she's from RD. She's from RD, which is the next parish. Now, she's long since gone from RD and is writing indeed from America and getting great acclaim over there. But she comes from County Louth. She's from the very next parish to where I came from. So I was delighted that one of her own was doing so well. Her book is lovely, and it's called The Language of Trees. And it's full of all sorts of interesting snippets about people's approach to trees and attitudes to trees and all the rest of it. A great read.
And speaking of trees, Aina, this is the sound of the great spotted woodpecker drumming in early spring to attract a mate and hold territory. Woodpeckers love trees, and our listeners love woodpeckers. Recently, as you know, I was at Bord Bia's Bloom in the Phoenix Park, and I met lots of our listeners who were admiring the gardens. And one of them had a question about woodpeckers.
How do I look for baby woodpeckers?
Now, what's your name?
Bridget Kinsley.
And where are you from?
Wexford, Kinbark Nurseries.
Oh, you've got the great spotted woodpecker on your bird feeders.
Yes.
My goodness. And what do you want to know?
Because
you're
now,
showing me a, I should point out that you're actually showing me a video on your mobile phone.
Is that the male with a red on his head? We have one with a red on his head and we have one without red. So does that mean male and female?
Well, that's a good question. I think the answer is yes. And I think the one with the red is the male.
Yes. But I would like to mind the little babies if I find them.
Oh, you don't have
them.
To do anything. No, don't find them and don't do anything.
No.
They don't need minding.
Yeah.
They're
no, we have
themselves.
A lot of trees for them to...
And do you ever hear them drumming?
On.
That's the sound they make.
No.
That kind of sound.
Oh,
you never
yes.
hear that?
There's so many sounds around us with birds and there's
crows in it. But
that's
a very distinct sound now.
Yeah.
That's them drumming on the tree.
Sometimes I don't listen enough for sounds. We're busy.
Yeah, well, I know life is very busy. It is.
but I listen now when I go home. Look, thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you for talking to us.
Don't
mind them. They can mind themselves.
Okay.
Let them do their own thing.
Okay.
That's the best way to treat all animals.
Yeah.
They've managed so far without us. You know?
Yeah, it's just I was curious how one tree...
But it's beautiful to have them. You're very lucky. And you know, they were extinct from Ireland up until very recently.
You,
they're only coming back.
It's only when I heard you saying that.
So Birdwatch Ireland will be delighted to know that you've got them in Wexford as well.
Okay,
which part of Wexford, so I can let them know?
I'm Ferns, near Gorey, Camolin.
I know it well, yeah. All right, girls, thanks very much indeed.
My brother-in-law has... woodpeckers as well, in Oilgate.
In Oilgate
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
God, the place is full of woodpeckers.
Thanks, Derek.
Bye. That was Bridget and her friend and Bloom with questions about woodpeckers and sightings of woodpeckers. The place is full of them, Wexford, it seems, anyway. Which is great news for Birdwatch Ireland. Speaking of which, Niall Hatch is now in studio with me and Richard Collins joins us from his home in Malahide. Niall, am I right? That red spot indicates the male, does it not?
You're spot on, Derek. You don't need me at all.
Spot on indeed.
You've got
yes.
it there. No, that's right. So the male and female of the great spotted woodpecker, which is the woodpecker species we're talking about here, they look extremely similar. But if you see this flash of red on the back of the head, that's the male. Now, it's only a small patch. It can be hard to see. But if the bird has its back to you, you can see it quite well. And the female doesn't have that. Her head just has black and white on it. So that's the way you could tell them, at least when they're adults. Mm. But the situation is complicated a bit when you're looking at the young birds, at the juveniles, because for the first while that they spend out of the nest and they're finding their way in the world, they mainly have red on most of their heads, but it's very variable. You do get some that don't have much red at all, so it is quite a variable feature. But for the adult ones, at least, patch of red on the back of the head, male, no patch of red on the back, it's a female.
All right, and to know they're in Oilgate as well?
Well, it certainly is interesting. We're getting more and more records of them in Wexford. The initial colonisation spot was in Wicklow, and birds flew across the Irish Sea from Wales. We know simultaneously there was a colonisation from Scotland across the County Down. The birds in Wicklow have been doing very well and it's spreading into neighbouring counties, including Wexford. So we are getting more reports as they're heading through the county. So people there could expect to see them more frequently, but it's still really good to have those records because it's still in the early stages of colonisation.
Richard, you'll remember in the early days of the colonisation of the great spotted woodpecker, you and I went to a house in Kilmechanic in County Wicklow to look at one on a hanging feeder.
Yes, indeed we did. On the red spot at the back of the head, I have a strange idea that occurred to me, that red spot is actually a copulator inhibitor. If you look at where it's located, the male is coming in to mate with what he thinks is a female, and he's confronted with the back of the head of his proposed beloved, and there is this bright red bar running across at eye level. Now, this would seem to me a deterrent, a trigger. Plumage has many functions, but among them is this to lead the male to select and mate with the correct female and so forth. And I suspect that that is the case here too. I don't know, I've never seen it in print, but I think that must be something to do with it.
Well, we'll ask Declan Murphy, who's written a book about this, in just a moment. Well, not about that specifically, but he wrote a book called A Life in the Trees, a personal account of the great spotted woodpecker. We'll ask him in just a moment. But we better clarify for the listener, is it a spot or is it a patch?
It's a rectangle, actually.
Yeah, there you go.
And it stretches across. It's long right left and it's short up down. And that's my memory of it now. I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time. But it seems to me a regular geometrical shape at the back of the nape. Quite small, but bright and clear.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the words like spot and patch, they don't have a geometric definition. It's a relatively small area of featherings. It's not we're talking about a large extensive area. So,
but presumably that is why it's called the great spotted.
The reason it's called great spotted is more because of the white spots that you see in the wings of the bird.
Okay.
And there's two other types of spotted woodpecker in Europe, so-called. So there's the lesser spotted woodpecker and the middle spotted woodpecker. So that's distinguished. It's the biggest of those three.
Okay, well let's, as I said, bring in Declan Murphy, author of A Life in the Trees, a personal account of the great spotted woodpecker. So Declan, you heard what Richard had to say there. This is a warning to other males, don't mate with me, I'm a male too. What do you think?
Okay, well that's certainly an interesting question by Richard there about that red spot. As he pointed out, we don't actually know the specific reason. I certainly know from my observations that of watching woodpeckers that I don't think I've ever seen a case where a male has even come close enough to copulate with another male by, you know, mistaking it for a female. Usually the territories are quite well defended and it's very rare to see two males in the same territory. And if they do come in, they'll be very aggressive. So it is a theory that it could have developed for that reason, and possibly it enables other males to see from quite a considerable distance without having to get too near that this territory is already occupied. Because unlike many birds, in which case the male sings to defend a territory, both the male and the female great spotted woodpecker drum. So the drumming is what proclaims, it's the sound a woodpecker makes when it's striking a tree with its bill. you hear it in the spring. But both the male and female do it to attract a mate or to proclaim a territory. So an individual male investigating a territory just because there's a bird drumming wouldn't know whether it's a male or female. So possibly the red spot at the back of the nape would be visible, because when a bird drums, it perches vertically on the tree, facing the tree trunk. So the red spot is actually facing away from the tree. So it would be very, very visible to a bird quite some distance away. And that would instantly identify to an intruding male that there is another male present in this territory. So rather than, I suppose my theory would be, rather than preventing another male copulating, it actually prevents two males actually having to waste precious energy and resources in fighting. Because as soon as they look into a territory, they can tell from a distance that there is another bird there, the territory is occupied, and they'll move off to try and find another unoccupied territory, I should say. So I suppose that would be my theory on the red spot plumage.
Yes, that's very plausible. I think you're right. It is interesting, though, the position of this particular blob is what interests me. Why it should be there and so neat and confined to that space. If you wanted to deter the males in general, you would have a much more extensive, something that could be seen from the sides and the front and everywhere.
Well, I think, Richard, if you think back to, as I was saying, to when they're actually drumming, they're facing the tree completely. So the spot is actually looking straight out, as it were, from the tree. And it is actually quite visible from the side. When we're watching the woodpeckers coming into nests to feed, we can actually see the red spot, whether the bird is sideways on or back on. So you get a full 180 degree view from wherever you look of that red spot. And it's, I know, as Niall said, it's a surprise. It's just a small rectangular. You're saying the same. Is it a spot or a patch? But the bright crimson colour of it, it's remarkably vibrant. And you can see it even in binoculars. Like, I was watching one there this morning, and I was about just using binoculars from about 150, 200 metres away. And I could readily identify the male and the female by that small patch as soon as they came into the nest. So it does seem to work and in sending out the signal as to which one is the male, which one is the female. So I presume, I mean, that we know birds have very good eyesight. To them, it could look, you know, very, very bright and very, very obvious. And it obviously does the job.
Declan, we know that many birds do indeed have much better colour vision than we do, particularly when it comes to shades of red. And also, red plumage in birds, it's not something that they can intrinsically make themselves. They get those red pigments from their diet. So a bird with particularly vibrant red coloration is sending a signal to potential mates and potential rival males that it's particularly strong and healthy. It's well fed. It's been having really a lot of nutrition. Also, that its territory is meeting its nutritional needs. It could be perhaps that this is a sign of fitness to potential mates in terms of females, and then also potential rival males, by showing that that particular bird is particularly strong and healthy. And it could be that the woodpecker's eyes are better at distinguishing between different shades of that red than human eyes are. To us, it may all look the same shade of red. To them, it might actually look quite different.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that, Niall. I think the one thing that we often tend to overlook as bird watchers, and that is that all birds and insects and things like that, they have a different spectrum. And we know that, like, for example, the way insects and that can see ultraviolet, and the patterns on flowers look totally different. Birds' eyes do see things different. We can't actually imagine how that red could be almost like a beacon coming out, where to us it's quite just a red similar to any other shade of red. It could be a very, very vibrant colour flashing out like a torchlight almost. And you're quite right in the saying that they manufacture that from their food. And of course, the better the quality of the food in a territory, the stronger the male will be, the more suitable the territory will be for rearing a family. So the very vividness of each male's colour is basically sending out the signal that this is where you want to have to rear a family. This is a territory worth defending. And I'm a strong, vibrant male that is, you know, able to defend this territory and protect the family. And I suppose that's the sort of characters that a female early in the season is looking for. She's looking for a potential mate that will be strong enough to defend the family, provide the food, and pass on everything to the next generation. For such a small part of the bird's plumage, it's obviously a very, very important fact in their lives.
Declan, it's an intriguing subject that you're dishing up now. It'd be very hard to test these things, but that's the joy of it in a way.
Well, I think the one that we haven't really touched on, Richard, and I might be interested in hearing your own thoughts on this, is that's discussing why the male has the spot. But what we haven't really touched on is the other end, is that the juvenile birds, as Niall pointed out, have red heads for 3 or 4 months of the year from when they leave the nest. Now, I was watching one this morning, just getting ready to leave the nest, and he's sticking his head out, and he has a crimson, very dark patch of red just on the forehead. Now, his sibling has a bright red crown that goes all over, so they vary considerably. And we have to ask ourselves, well, what? There's two questions on that. What, first of all, what is the purpose of the actual red crown on a juvenile? Because whatever the purpose is, it doesn't serve any purpose later on in life, because they become either a male or a female and adapt the male or the female plumage. The next thing is why does it vary? Is there an advantage to having a full red crown that extends from the base of the bill right over the forehead and the crown down the nape, as opposed to one that just has a small red patch on the forehead? And in some cases, they don't have any red at all, and they have a completely black crown, the same as a female. And that can all be in the one brood. So you can have a brood of chicks that we would actually be able to identify each individual one by the red pattern. So there's an interesting question now as to what is the purpose of it on the juveniles, both in the variation of it and the few months, what's the importance of it in the few months that it's present in their plumage?
Well, two possibilities. One is that before it fledges, it's in the nest and it has got these triggers to encourage. It's what, something like 20 to 24 days in the nest before it leaves, and it has to trigger the parents into feeding it. And colours like that, like the robin's gape or whatever, the gape flashed, makes the parents go off and get it a worm or whatever. And tests show that birds will exhaust themselves if you put in artificial gapes and so on. Now, in this case, the extra coloration will trigger that kind of behavior in the parents. And when it leaves the nest, there's a period of dependence where it's flying around. And it can be in woodland and places like that. So it's plausible that this kind of variation in head plumage is rather like a method of identifying your children or whatever. It's making them distinctive so that the parents know their own and don't put the food into the next guy's bill. What do you think of that kind of idea?
I've kind of come to that conclusion myself, that the ones with the more extensive red crowns tend to leave the nest a little bit earlier. That's the impression we normally get, because as the young chicks develop, they come to the entrance of the nest hole and they stick their heads out to be fed. And quite often, the one that's sticking its head out first or the most frequently has a very vibrant red crown. So that would suggest that that's the stronger bird. And then when that bird has left the nest, we get the chance to see the next bird in the queue, as it were, that comes up. And quite frequently that has less red or sometimes no red at all. And there's a chick I was watching this morning, only a couple of hours ago, up in Wicklow. And it seems to be the last one to be leaving the nest. And it's looking out very, very healthy, very, very strong, calling away, being fed by the parents. But it has very little red on its crown. And it seems to be the last bird, or I haven't seen any other bird at the nest leaving, so possibly it could only be the only bird in it. But it would suggest that the ones with the very red heads are getting fed more, because they seem to be able to leave the nest a day or two in advance of the ones with less red. So that would make sense if they are dominating the food and the parents are coming in and the parents are just feeding the one with the most red head. It gets the majority of the food, develops a day or two earlier, and then leaves. Now, if there's a good food supply, that doesn't make much difference to the whole brood, because they will all get fed the right amount. And as the older ones leave, the parents carry on feeding the younger ones. So in a good year with a good territory, there isn't necessarily, I imagine, an advantage, because the whole brood will succeed and go. But if it's a bad year and food is in short supply, there mightn't be enough food to feed 5 or 6 chicks in the nest. And then the one with the most red on the head, the stronger one, will get all the food that's required for it to develop and get out. And its siblings, who may not have as much red on the head, there may not be enough food, and they may not develop sufficiently enough to be able to leave the nest and survive outside. That would be my theory at the moment, anyway, from watching them.
Declan, that makes sense to me. It's a very interesting observation, actually, that you're seeing that the birds with the juveniles with the most red on the head tend to be, at least on average, the birds to leave earlier. It does tie into the idea that this red pigment being derived from their diet, it indicates a bird that's particularly fit and healthy. And interestingly, we know that in birds that display prominent patches of red or indeed yellow plumage, which also comes from the diet, it's also an indicator sometimes of immune system health, because the same chemicals that produce those colours in those birds, they're also what are used to boost the immune system. So a bird that has a weak immune system has to divert more of that coloration to boost that immune system rather than put it through into its plumage, whereas birds that have great immune systems have red to spare, as it may be. So maybe that's what's happening. And as you say, it could well be a signal to the parents as to, if resources are limited, which birds should they invest their limited resources in to ensure the maximum chances of survival of their own genetic lineage? Or it could also be, if feeding is very good, which of their offspring need the most help? And maybe it's a signal for that as well.
That's true, yeah. If there's a good food supply and there's one or two that may be weaker, they possibly may have hatched a day or two later. That often happens with, as you know, with other birds like barn owls and things like that, for example, and the development is staggered over a period of days. Now, that does seem to happen with woodpeckers a little, that the birds seem to start incubating from the minute the first egg is laid. So by the time the first one hatches, the last one then doesn't hatch for another 2 or 3 days. So they would need more food. So possibly the fact, if they were ones, again, depending on the coloration, any of the ones that have the less red on the head, the parents may concentrate on them more. But I mean, the good news is this year is, although the birds are seen to have bred much later, much, much later than in previous years, they're several weeks behind actually in some territories, they do seem to have good, strong, healthy chicks. And there's several nests I'm watching at the moment, including one this morning, as I said earlier, where the chicks are getting ready to leave. They seem very strong and healthy, regardless of the amount of red they have. So there does seem to be sufficient food at the moment out there for them all. Possibly the change, the colder spring, delayed breeding a little bit this year, and that's why they're later. But every year is different, as you know, with all birds, Niall. You know, that's what makes it all so interesting, really, that no 2 years are the same. The territories are never the same. There's always something to be learned. And as Richard pointed out, even at this stage, we still aren't 100% sure of things as seemingly straightforward as the colour of the birds and their plumage as to what it all means. So plenty to be learned out there. Never a case of that there's nothing new to be learned.
Never a dull moment. Thank you very much indeed, Declan Murphy. And his book is called A Life in the Trees, A Personal Account of the Great Spotted Woodpecker. And you can find all the details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now back to a book we mentioned at the top of the programme. Let me read you what the Washington Post had to say about this book. It said, "Communicators, migrants, soothsayers, beings more deserving of the rights of personhood than the corporations that have been conferred that legal protection. Editor and artist Katie Holton celebrates all the ways trees are infinitely more complex than commonly envisioned." The book is called The Language of Trees, A Rewilding of Literature and Landscape. It's a journey from prehistoric cave paintings to tree clocks in Mongolia to the death of a 3,500-year-old cypress tree. And it's a timely reminder of what could happen if we allow the arboreal beauty that surrounds us to slip away. The editor is Katie Holton, and she joins us now from her hotel room in London. Hello, Katie.
Hi, Derek. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so the book is a celebration of trees, and it's called The Language of Trees. So obviously it makes you think it's about trees, but I think it's also really about being human and being a member of a community. I've got one of my tree drawings on the cover shows a forest, how the trees are all connected with the root system underneath. And I feel like that's how humans are. We're all connected and we work together through, you know, our towns, villages, communities, cities on this big, beautiful planet. So I think if we could just learn maybe to slow down and listen to trees, it might teach us and help us to maybe become better lovers of the world and take better care of it and ourselves. And it's about a lot of things. So maybe I'll go quiet now and let you throw some questions at me, because I could talk for days about this book.
Yes, indeed. I'll have to confess a conflict of interest here, Katie, won't I? First of all, I've been speaking to you before and communicating with you. And secondly, you come from RD in County Louth, the very next parish to where I come from myself. So you're a local woman, in spite of being introduced and being spoken about on the Washington Post and New York City and everything else. You're a local Louth girl, aren't you?
And thank you for being part of the community and the stories and answering questions when I reached out to you.
Your book is The Language of Trees. And in fact, when you were speaking to me, we were talking about the fact of a tree language and a tree alphabet. And you, in fact, invented a tree alphabet yourself, quite a different one to the one that went on to form Orm way back in the day. So you have beautiful images all through the book of pictures and indeed writing that you have using your tree alphabet, where you have your 26 little stick drawings, if you like, of trees, and they all stand for a certain letter. So this is what you're saying in the book, that anything that we can say or write or whatever can be translated into using these letters to give an image of the world through trees. So could you say a little bit more about how you feel this is working?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, being Irish, we all know about this Irish tree alphabet, so the medieval Orm, going back to like the 5th century, and it's something I feel, you know, at a cellular level is part of who I am. I've always known that we have an Irish tree alphabet, but I didn't really understand what it was or how it worked or how it was communicated. Then it was during lockdown in 2020, I started looking at it again, and I when I looked closely, I realised it was actually written the way trees and plants grow. So they wrote it, they drew it from the ground up. And so from the ground up, you have a main trunk, a straight line, and then the little twigs come out on either side, and that indicates what the different letter was. And I realised that's just how trees grow, and then each one of the letters, they stacked on top of the other. So the words were written from the ground up, the way trees grow. And it just felt like everything kind of fell into place, and I knew this old medieval Irish tree alphabet was something that makes so much sense for us right now. We're in the 21st century. We're rushing towards this uncertain future that looks very difficult, full of the climate emergency, the climate crisis. So if we could maybe slow down and think maybe call it tree time. So slow everything down and try and look at things through a tree lens or a plant lens, maybe beyond our human-centric way of thinking about things. Realize we are just one little animal on this planet. And so the tree alphabet was my offering to try and have a non-human centred way of thinking about language and communication and being together.
This is one aspect of your book. But in the main, when you pick up your book, what you realise, what you're holding, in fact, is a collection of essays or poems or short bits by about 50 authors, all of whom have something to say about trees. And you have sort of sorted this out into seeds, buds, leaves and trunks, flowers and fruit, forests, tree time, these topics, these headings. Now, mind you, there are very, very few of these authors that are not American, but there are a few. And I was just picking out, being as we are in Ireland, picking out the Irish authors. So we have Kerry Ní Dougherty, and she's talking about, you know, the whole idea of when we were in Ireland in the Irish language, that there's a connection between the trees and the next world and the other world and the portal between one and another. That whole concept of trees beside holy wells, in fact, which goes way back before Christianity. And then you have a poem then on Drine on Dun by Susan McKeown, The Blackthorn Tree. And that has another lovely Irish ring to it as well. But in the main, your authors are American authors that you have throughout the whole book. And it's their thoughts about trees that is what you have put in the book in the main.
Yeah, I think because I was invited by the US publisher Tin House to recreate a book that I made back in 2015. So it became, if you will, the book, The Language of Trees, was published in April over in the States. So that's how it kind of grew. I made it during the last year. So the book happened very quickly in 1 year. So I sort of reached out to who was close to me, who I had relationship with, and who seemed to make sense to communicate with a book that was being published in the States. Because we only realized this year in January that the book was going to come out here. And I did naively think I could get to make it a whole new version of the book for the Irish UK edition. But that's not how the publishing industry works, sadly. But I did manage managed to slip in Kerini Doherty. There's also Mary Reynolds shares her work with the We Are the Ark, and people like Rob McFarlane, Zadie Smith, some UK, not Irish, but close enough. But yes, I had really hoped that we would have a whole new family conversation. And I think now that I'm on the book tour, that's one way that I get to do that. So I get to travel around the country and open up the conversations. For me, the book tour is really a way to turn the book, that's this time capsule, if you will. It's something you can hold in your hands and you can flip through or leaf through the pages. And so for me, that's a really important part of it on the tour. And so I'm looking forward to visiting Cork and Clare and the Burren next week and the week after, and engaging with groups like Home Tree and Owen Dalton. And that's, I think, another aspect of the book is that it exists beyond the pages. It's really, for me, like the tree alphabets are something that I make available on my website, so people can download the tree fonts and they can write with trees. So I really feel like the book is much more than a physical entity. It's something that lives out in the world and exists. People can write their own messages, and we can actually plant messages with trees, because I've made an Irish tree alphabet that can be planted, so we can plant words and messages to the future.
If we go back to our roots, they are ultimately arboreal. The great apes from which we come lived in the trees. We came down and ventured out into the open plains and so forth. But is there a hankering in us for our arboreal past? A sense that we have broken with our true roots or something? Is there a strange psychological readdressing of that? Now, you mentioned Om. Om is an interesting phenomenon in a way, this strange language here in Ireland back in the 4th century or thereabouts. It seems it may have been invented so that you could communicate with people who would know what you were saying, a kind of an encryption, a kind of a code, in a sense. Your tree book, I looked at your tree drawings. I must say I would find it very difficult to read anything in them, just as it would be very difficult to read anything in Om. Is there a sense of a special private language about this?
Yeah, I like that you mentioned, used the word readdressing. For me, it's really about remembering, trying to remember who we are, like as a species. This might sound very grand and over the top and a bit crazy, but I think in general, there's such a disconnect, right? The Western cultures, we've become so disconnected from the landscape in which we live. We can't live without the landscape that we're a part of. We need it. And this remembering where we come from, remembering our creation stories. You know, I've been hosting a series of salons where we talk about the possibilities for art and activism, and just for being a human right now in this time of a climate emergency. What can we do? How can we survive? And we keep coming back to storytelling and the importance of having stories and remembering our old stories and the creation stories. And I think in Ireland, we've got such a rich history. We've got all of our myths, and these are so important. You know, Mankin has been helping us remember. And I think this is definitely something that I hope the book is offering a way for people just to remember. And so the trees, yes, it might be difficult to translate and to read in trees, but some of the offerings are just like a single word or letter by letter. So you can slowly learn the trees and learn to read them. And just the simple act of slowing down, I think, is, for me, was a really important part of making the tree alphabet, was to say, look, we're moving too quickly. We're not stopping and paying attention to what's right here in front of us. We're not seeing the trees, if you will. And so just to remember who we are and where we come from. The fact that we'd forgotten that we had an Irish rainforest was the natural ecosystem in a lot of the West Coast. And it's only in the last few years, through all of these rewilding efforts, that we've started to remember. And I think this, rewilding our hearts and our imaginations is such an important part of what we can do right now, is we're all feeling kind of hopeless, or at least I've been feeling hopeless and scared and angry about what we can do in such a difficult time. And so offering something as simple as trees to remember, I think, is it's like a simple looking at the ABC. It's like learning the ABC all over again. Learn your AB trees.
So you're trying to revive transcendentalism, are you? Ralph Waldo Emerson, the famous American naturalist back in the 19th century, believed in the inherent goodness of people and nature. Society had introduced corruption, but the physical and spiritual process, there's an inherent dynamism in all things. Is this the sort of theme, the sort of message, if there is a message, that you want to get out in this book?
Yeah, I definitely think that we need to remember that we humans are just one animal. We're an animal ourselves. I think we've sort of somehow forgotten that we actually are animals. And to remember that everything is alive. We're made up of stardust, and every atom, every molecule in the universe all came from that, you know, Big Bang, or if there was something before it. And so we are all related, and everything is communicating. I think this is something, you know, we also tend to forget, that we have our human language where we can communicate with each other, and it's such an important part of being human. And everything is communicating all the time. It's just maybe at a different frequency, or it's something that we can't tune into or hear. So we know that now that, you know, trees communicate, and a lot of the scientists, some of them included in the book, share studies showing. So it's like we're suddenly realizing how we are not maybe at the top of the pyramid, and that we're not the all-powerful human who is in charge of everything and can extract and consume the planet at will and just keep on growing. You know, so much of our societies are about growth, endless growth. And we have to remember, well, this is just one planet, and we're just one little species. And we all need to live together and remember that we have to be in relationship. And that's why I think remembering to look to the land and where we live is so important. And I feel like my book is part of my campaign for rights of nature, to try and show we need to protect nature, because that's a way to protect ourselves. You know, if we protect plants and trees, we're really protecting ourselves and our families and our communities.
Why Not? The Language of Trees, a Rewilding of Literature and Landscape by Katie Holton, is published by Elliot and Thompson, and more details can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Katie, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much, Turk.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Taking flight, the first four of 16 white-tailed sea eagle chicks were released into the wild today as part of a conservation project to reintroduce the bird to Irish shores. The chicks were brought to Ireland from Norway last month.
And they transported them from Trondheim to Kerry Airport. We collected them and we put them in purpose-built release cages where we've held them for the last 6 weeks. We've fed them, we've watched them, we've fed them fish, and they have now developed to the point where they're strong enough and their feathers are fully grown, and they're now ready to fly out into the wild environment in Ireland.
That was wildlife ranger Eamon Meskell of the National Parks and Wildlife Service speaking in a report by Laura Hogan for RTE News on the white-tailed sea eagle chicks being released into the wild in Munster 120 years after the species became extinct in Ireland. That programme began in 2007 and has been a huge success story for conservation in Ireland, most recently with the hatching of five new chicks on the shores of Lough Derg. And the National Parks and Wildlife Service are preparing for the potential reintroduction of another bird of prey this summer with the arrival of the first 12 osprey chicks later this month. Eamon Meskell joins us now from Killarney National Park. Hello, Eamon.
Hi, Derek.
It's great to speak with you again. Take us back to the beginning of this project.
The project was initiated in the early 2000s. So in around 2004, the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the Golden Eagle Trust and others came into a room and started hatching the plan, to pardon the pun, to see if it was possible to get the reintroduction of a species that was once present in Ireland back into the Irish countryside. By doing that, it just wasn't an idea that was pulled from the clouds. This was all part of the Convention of Biological Diversity, where Ireland is a signatory, and part of that, one of the pillars of that, is to reintroduce a species that was once present in the country. So we got the heads around the table to see, was it possible? But a lot of work had to be done. We had to contact our Norwegian partners to get a suitable donor stock to see could we get wild chicks from the nest of white-tailed eagles in Norway and get them sent to Ireland, taken from those nest sites and taken and sent back to Ireland so that we could release them from purpose-built release cages in the wild and manage them over that 6 weeks until they got fully fledged and release them out into the wild, which we did. Initial reintroduction phase one was a six-year project where the plan was to bring back 100 white-tailed eagle chicks over that five-year period. That was 20 eagle chicks per year, which we did, and we released them completely from the release sites within Killarney National Park. So that's what happened, and we did that. We worked well with the local farmers, the local community, the Norwegians, all the authorities, and the project actually worked. So we got all those eagles into the wild, and the first sign of productivity was in 2012 when a pair of eagles that were released from Killarney National Park, the male in 2008 and the female in 2009, paired up on the shores of Loch Derg, made a nest, made a territory, but didn't hatch out any eggs that year. And that's completely normal for first-time young white-tailed sea eagles. So 2013, they got together again, same place, same territory, and lo and behold, that year, 2013 was the first time that we had two wild white-tailed eagle chicks born in the wild in 120 years in Ireland. So that was an actual, absolutely phenomenal feat. And over the course of the next 7 or 8 years then, many more territories were formed, as in 7 or 8 or 9 territories were formed from Glengariff all the way up along the Shannon Flyway, as we call the lakes of Loch Derg and Loch Allen and Loch Ree. And we got 7 more pairs breeding in the wild, but because of climatic factors and weather factors and everything like that, the success of the fledging rate of the white-tailed eagle chicks was not 100%, because we had hurricanes, we had storms at critical times when the nests were literally blown off the trees. So we had a good return up until 2019. We had about 10 territories at that stage set up. We had about 25 or 30 wild eagles in the wild. We also had about a further 25 white-tailed eagle chicks that were born in the wild. But in 2019, we had a scientific review done of the project at that stage to tell us how it was going, how the modelling was going, to see were we being successful, was it going to last, was it going to sustain itself, the project in the wild. So, look, the findings of that review came back and said that, yes, we were doing a really good job. The project itself was working, but it needed an injection of a fresh cohort of white-tailed eagle chicks, yeah, to be brought over a five-year period, just to, you know, breed life into the project and to create a situation where we may have had too many males or too many females in one area or another, and that would give them the option of pairing up in the wild. So lo and behold, in 2020, which was the start of COVID, we started white-tailed eagle reintroduction phase two. And the plan for phase two was to bring over maybe 60 eagles over a five-year period from Norway again. So we went back to the Norwegians. We set up our partnerships again. And for the difference, I suppose, between the white-tailed eagle phase two as opposed to white-tailed eagle phase one was that white-tailed eagle phase two was completely led and managed by National Parks and Wildlife Service staff. And we also extended the range of the release sites from Killarney, which we included Killarney as well, but we also brought it up through the Shannon Estuary, on into Loch Derg and down into County Waterford. And also now we've opened up Loch Corrib as well as another potential release site. So from the point of view of that, it created a whole new scheme of works, but we based our work ethic and methodology on what we'd learned in the reintroduction phase one, as in the release cages were built the same, the preparation was the same, the feeding habits were the same, the satellite tagging was the same, the monitoring of the white-tailed eagles as they flew around was the same. So everything kind of dovetailed from phase one into phase two. And the really good news this year is that the pairing of the two projects, phase phase one and two came together in Lough Derg, again, where we had a male, the first male actually that fledged that young pair in 2013 with a female. His female died, and he's after setting up territory now with a three-year-old white-tailed eagle chick released in phase two of the project.
Oh, fantastic. So that's great news. But how many white-tailed sea eagles, to the best of your knowledge, are there now flying in the skies over Ireland?
Well, you see, it sounds like there's an awful lot, Derek, but the reality of it is, look, between all the eagles that were released and all the eagles that were fledged in the wild and more eagles that came in reintroduction phase two, you're possibly looking at about 65 white-tailed eagles in the country at the moment. And you know, when you consider the size of Ireland, when you consider the territories, the lakes, the islands, the coastline we have, that's not a terribly significant amount. But look, if we can get maybe up to 15 or 16 designated territories where we have pairs of white-tailed eagles traditionally nesting in those areas, well, then we feel that the project at that stage will be sustainable.
What's the critical number?
That would be the kind of a critical number, and that's a great question. I mean, and your wording is absolutely brilliant. What we have to deal with is critical mass. Because if we're, for instance, if we're releasing into an area, you just don't release white-tailed eagles into the one area and then go away from it. You have to create a critical mass in that area where there's enough males to female ratio that over the course of 5 years to 7 years, when they're becoming adults and mature, that they'll have enough opportunities to pair up. So that's where the critical mass. So the critical mass in Ireland at the moment is still below par on the critical mass that we need for a viable, sustainable population. But when we've looked at the other models of the other areas where the reintroductions have taken place, we're ahead of those areas at this particular point
in time. But is there a number? Is it 70 birds? Is it 100 birds? Is it 70 pairs? Is it 100 pairs? What's the number?
When we get to a number of something in the region of 20 pairs of white-tailed eagles with territories and are able to fledge chicks, white-tailed eagle chicks in the wild, well, then we'll feel that we're at the critical mass stage that we have a sustainable project at that stage.
Eamon, it's Niall here. It's great to hear that this project is going from strength to strength. I know there's a long way to go yet. Part of the reason for that, of course, is that these white-tailed seagulls, it takes them quite a long time to reach breeding maturity compared to, say, the robins or the blackbirds in our back gardens, which will often breed in their first year. In relation to that, it would suggest, obviously, that there is quite a high mortality rate among these birds and also quite a low success rate, initially at least, in terms of the pairs nesting. Do we know the reasons for that? And have the reasons for the initial extinction of this species in Ireland been fully addressed? Are they in the past?
You know something, Niall, it really is where we're at the moment with that project, and it is finding its feet, and it's taking a long time for it to find its feet. And as you say, it's one of those long-term projects. Now, what we had to do was we had to go through, not alone were we members of the Convention on Biological Diversity and partnerships in that, but we also have to fill the criteria of IUCN guideline criteria when we're reintroducing a species. And that's all part of the criteria. One of the ones that you're after mentioning is, why did the eagles disappear in the first place? You had to address that and find out why. We did. It was persecution. It was all these kind of things. And have we addressed that to the extent where we feel that we're able to overcome that issue? We have addressed it, and we feel we're at the stage now where we're able to overcome it. There are issues there with the white-tailed eagles existing in the wild. The issues would be the three main ones, I suppose, would be, look, avian influenza. A past historical one was the use of poisons, which unfortunately is still there but is dying out. It's getting more less and less. And the other one then would be the wind turbines and all these, you know, they're flying birds that fly hard and fast when they're going and high. A lot of wind turbines coming along on the scene and the slopes of the mountains and everywhere in Ireland. I mean, it's another factor. And also, I mean, there's the fight. They're wild animals out there in the wild, and they do fight for territory and unfortunately kill each other as well. So we have all those factors which are natural and non-natural, but we seem to be, I mean, really, we were shaking our knees at the start of this season with the amount of avian influenza that was around, with all the gannets and everything like that that were dying off the coast of Ireland, down the Skelligs and up as far as Scotland and everything like that. And that was only 6 months ago. I think we were getting something like 300-400 dead gannets a day and off the Skelligs at the time. And that dovetailed at the time when the released eagle chicks from last year were flying to the coast and flying out and expanding their territory. So we were really afraid of that, but it didn't. I think we lost one eagle out of the last, out of, what was it, 15 last year to avian influenza. So look, there are factors out there. It would really, that's why it's long term, and that's why it's important to have the satellite tags and everything like that, so that we can monitor and follow the eagles' progress and see where they're at and be able to kind of manage them to a certain degree when they're out in the wild. Even though when they're out there, look, when they're released and they're gone, they're really gone, and it's up to themselves at that stage.
I'm really glad to hear, Eamon, that that they seem to be weathering the storm of avian flu quite well, because obviously it's something that many seabirds and large birds of prey like eagles have in common, is that because it takes so long for them to get to reach sexual maturity and to breed, if even a few are taken out of the population by a sudden disease incident like that, that can have repercussions for many, many years, that the species isn't as resilient, isn't able to bounce back as quickly. I know a lot of people contact us here at Moon Goes Wild and in Birdwatch Ireland as well, thinking, or at least hoping, that they've seen white-tailed eagles. Because although the numbers are increasing, it's still in national terms a rare species. It's hard to come across them. A lot of people I know have been seeing buzzards, these large birds of prey, thinking that they're eagles. You know,
everywhere, everywhere at the moment.
Absolutely. And a buzzard, you know, people who aren't familiar with them, they are certainly a very big, impressive bird. But they're nothing compared to a white-tailed eagle. How could people distinguish the white-tailed eagle from other birds of prey? And will you always see a white tail on them?
Do you know something? It goes back to the maturity, the colouring. Eagles, it takes them at least 5 years. Now we have a most unusual incident with the three-year-old female bee, Bernardine, in Loch Derrick, who is now sitting on an extra two chicks. But, I mean, the white tail doesn't come into play until they're 5 years old. That shows that they're mature enough to breed, and that's when you see the white tail. And also the head goes white at that stage, and the beak goes this coloured yellow as well. Very impressive. But how do you know them from, for instance, the difference between a white-tailed eagle and a buzzard? The only way that I could be describing it all day, but the only way that I could say it to you is that, look, if you're not sure it's a white-tailed eagle, it's not a white-tailed eagle. Because when you see a white-tailed eagle flying, it is one of the most impressive sights you'll ever see in your life. It's got that big, massive wingspan. Even though you see a buzzard and you say, that is big, the white-tailed eagle is just so big. And like they call it the flying barn door, and that's what it's like. It's like a barn door flying in the sky. So really, that's the only way that we can decipher the size and everything like that. And you know something? It's true what you say. A lot of people may not even know where to find and see a white-tailed eagle, even though they want to, because they're quite secretive. They only they fly a certain time of the day, not all of the time, and you've got to be fast and quick and be able to identify them where we're in the lucky position where we're able to follow satellite tags and see where the eagles are and everything like that. But for the ordinary punter in the wild, it's a rare occurrence to actually see one, but it's quite dramatic when you do see one.
Richard.
Eamon. Tell me, is there any possibility or any worry about a genetic bottleneck? For instance, if you were to release the birds in Donegal or Rathlin Island or someplace like that, there would be a greater possibility of connection with the Scottish population, and this would diversify the genes. To what extent do the Scots birds relate to Norwegians? It would be healthier if we had a continuous chain all the way along Western Europe for this bird, or is this a crazy idea?
No, it's not a crazy idea at all, Richard. I mean, it's one of those things. And you know something, we're even this year, we're starting up a DNA sampling and genetic testing just to try and answer that very question that you're after posing. And I mean, the two birds that I talked about there on the shores of Loch Derg that are sitting there now, the 2008 released male and 2020 released female, the two of them were collected by the same volunteer west of Trondheim from two islands that were close together. So you could very well have that kind of a situation. And those are some of the stuff that we're going to learn along the way. And I mean, we're not too far away from Scotland. We've had some of our released white-tailed eagle chicks, for instance, within 2 months of being released in 2020. She was up in Inverness, up in Loch Ness for about 6 to 8 months. So, and we've also lost other female that have gone to Scotland and not come back, and they've bred over in Scotland. So we do have interchanging and interactions. Nothing has come from Norway, as far as I'm aware, over here in a natural state. So, but it would be good to have that line. But look, the buzzards were up there in County Antrim for years. They never came down. And all of a sudden, about 15 or 20 years ago, we started getting buzzards from Northern Ireland naturally. So you can never tell one, you know, these birds of prey are phenomenal, the way they can fly, the way they can travel, the way they can show up here, there and yonder. I mean, the world is their oyster, really. And it's not like they're flying around small little lakes and patches and areas, even though they do settle in territories. They could be maybe 7 kilometres to 10 kilometres territories when they do settle. But up until that time, they really fly the skies. So, I mean, from that point of view, they are a wide-ranging bird. I don't know, but I don't think that the DNA, too close DNA or genetics, could be a problem. But we'll learn as we go forward.
Well, so far, so good at any rate. Eamon, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Aina Nilana, Richard Collins and Niall Hatch. Our broadcast coordinator is Daniel Keating and our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. We'll do it all again next week. But do, in the meantime, visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Until next time, goodbye.